start by thanking the organizers for putting together this workshop and indeed this thematic program on string theory. It's a pleasure to be back in the Fields Institute. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about statistics of M-theory vacua and the landscape, and it's some work that was done in collaboration with Frederick Deneff and my student Roberto Valandro. Even though we're in the Fields Institute, perhaps a more apt location for this, some of these talks would be the building next door. I don't know if anyone, if some of you have noticed something, I'm sure you have, it's the Institute of Landscape and Architecture or something. All right, so let me begin with an overview of the talk. I'm going to give a brief introduction to the landscape, have some discussion on the question of why we should be interested perhaps in a statistical approach to studying some of the questions, to studying the landscape itself. We'll then go on to review some of the results in the type 2B flux landscape, which we've already heard about in previous talks. Our work was mainly concerned with the some different areas of the landscape, in particular M-theory flux landscapes. And we studied, in particular, G2 holonomy and Freund-Rubin vacua. So I'm going to give some brief reviews of some of the features of these vacua, just to orient us into the results. So then we'll go on to discuss the features we found in the Freund-Rubin landscape and similarly in the G2 landscape, and then we'll end with some discussion. So that's the first statement. Leads us into this idea of the landscape, which has been, this realization has been with us for a long time in string theory, but there appear to be a plethora of completely non-realistic string vacua. So here are some obvious examples: 11-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, type 2B on ADS cross ADS 5 cross S5, or the heterotic string on K3. These are all vacua which clearly do not describe the physics of our universe. And in the past 10 years or so, we've learned that these vacua can have dual descriptions, which, if you take the statement of duality exactly, it implies that some of these vacua are actually non-perturbatively exact vacua of the theory. So even though we maybe describe them in the supergravity limit, if you believe in dualities, strong weak coupling dualities, then these vacua are actually exact vacua of the theory. So this establishes that there exists. If this the duality is in fact true, then this would establish that these non-realistic string vacua actually exist. Now, so one way to phrase this statement, these results, is that even though M theory has apparently no free parameters, it does appear to have a large landscape of vacua. Now, you may just want to. We could, instead of focusing on these obviously non-realistic vacua, focus on those that are more realistic. So, for example, those that have four big space-time dimensions. But even by focusing on these, even though our results, for example, on the non-perturbative structure of these, non-perturbative existence of these, of such vacua, may not be as strong as in these cases. At least at the semi-classical level, the landscape of four-dimensional vacua also appears to be quite vast. So this question mark here is just to remind us that we should be healthily skeptical about such statements, and that we should certainly be open to the possibility that, you know, for example, type 2b flux vacua may, for some non-perturbative reason or from some subtle consistency condition, may not persist in the full quantum non-perturbative string theory. Although at this point, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any evidence to suggest that. Maybe I should also mention that Tom Banks has raised objections to the existence of the landscape on the grounds of making arguments such as, you know, if we picture this as if we picture these different vacua as critical points of some big effective potential on the configuration space, then attempting to create, say, one vacuum while residing inside another vacuum by, say, tunneling or domain walls and so on, can lead one into some pathologies. For example, the creation of cosmological universes that quickly turn into black crunches, and he interprets that as being a pathology, and therefore suggests that we shouldn't think of these vacua as vacuum states in one single theory. But you know, it's not clear to me that that's the only way to populate the landscape, and the large volume supergravity approximation to those vacua that are well described by such an approximation seems to be good enough. But so for most of this talk, I'm not going to be worrying about populating the landscape and cosmological issues or cosmologically related issues. I'm just going to be defining the landscape as, you know, just a set of static known vacua in the sense of solutions of the theory. And I'm, you know, not going to be concerned with issues of sort of quantum gravitational nature, and most of the actual results I'm going to present, you know, can be interpreted simply as understanding properties of these vacua, but from this alternative statistical viewpoint that was forwarded by Michael Douglas. So these are just some examples of these would-be four-dimensional vacua. Now, in the case of the special holonomy compactifications, classically, as many of you know, there are fields in the theory which have no potential. So their VEVs are arbitrary, these so-called moduli fields, which are parameters of these continuous parameters of these special holonomy metrics. And by turning on magnetic fields in the extra dimensions, we've learned in more recent years, we can generate a potential for these moduli fields, which leads to a discretium of vacua, labeled by these integer flux parameters. So, in addition to these large numbers of classical compactifications, on top of this structure, so for a given Calabi-Yau, say, there's this lattice of fluxes. This lattice of fluxes, which picks out a lattice of points in the Calabi-Yau or G2 moduli space. So we have this very, on the face of it, very large discretium of vacua. So how can we make sense of this? So one thing is we could just simply, try and search among these vacua and try to find, models which describe the real world. But to emphasize one particular virtue of taking a more statistical approach along the lines that Mike Douglas been proposing, let me tell you a story of the unfortunate model builder. So this was a smart young phenomenologist, good friends with Nima Arkani Hamid, wanted to realize large extra dimensions and solve the hierarchy problem and put, realize a standard model on some brain. Extra dimensions are large. This guy also, knew a bit of string theory. And so he wanted to use fluxes to try to stabilize the moduli in this region, in the large volume region. So, he looked around for different, models, toroidal, orientifolds, G2 compactifications, you name it. He tried it, but after a couple of years, got a bit dejected and found that he couldn't stabilize the moduli where he wanted them to be stabilized, and failed to find a single model. Well, as we heard in Frederick's talk, by studying these flux vacua statistically, you can, in cases, rule out the existence of large volume region. There's an upper bound on the volume. And clearly our friend would have been an advantage to know this in advance. So there's an actual real practical utility from these statistical studies of the landscape. It can be a very useful tool for model building. And we'll see a similar example of this a bit later. So this is one motivation that I'm going to mention, and I'm not actually going to mention any others.
What's wrong with more vacua at last?
Hmm?
What's wrong?
what's wrong with it? Nothing's wrong with it. Actually, I quite like that idea myself. No, I wouldn't actually. I would take it as evidence for string theory, since it's the only consistent theory that we know that has extra dimensions in it. But I just personally do not like the idea of large extra dimensions, because it goes against some what I consider, you know, more natural ideas, such as grand unification and supersymmetry. But we may find out in a couple of years, hopefully. So, okay, after this, these comments, I just wanted to flash by you some questions, I mean, many of which were actually inspired by discussions I had with Mike Douglas. So one question, which I think is very sharply phrased and interesting one, is, are there finitely many four-dimensional vacua that have a finite volume and cosmological constant? So in other words, a finite fundamental scale and four-dimensional vacuum energy. So, I mean, this is, as we'll see, you can at least answer this question in various regions of the landscape. A braver question, a much more difficult one, is, are there finitely many vacua in this landscape which agree with the standard model at low energies? So out of this set, if so, for example, if you found that there were finitely many vacua with finite cosmological constants, are there finitely many vacua that out of those that agree with the standard model? Yeah, sorry. Obviously, this one follows if you answer affirmatively that one. But the answer to this could also be zero out of the. yeah. Sorry. And I mean, one would be interested in the ratio in the landscape, just the numerical density of these vacua to those vacua. You know, do you have to search through 10 to the 500 of these 4D vacua before you find a single standard model vacua, for example? And if you do have to, it's really probably not worth searching for such a thing. A more phenomenologically oriented question is there any sense in which vacua with small cosmological constant and Higgs mass prefer low-scale supersymmetry? I'm not going to elaborate on what one might mean by prefer, but I mean, numerically, there could be a numerical preference or statistical preference for such vacua. Few more thoughts. Well, one, if the landscape is so vast as it appears to be, how else can we make sense of it other than statistically? Clearly, naturalness becomes a very important issue if you can realize, for example, in the landscape any value of the cosmological constant that you want. What does that mean about naturalness in fundamental physics? Something which we may return to later briefly is that Nima and collaborators have been recently been inspired by this landscape idea, combined with essentially anthropic arguments The positive thing is that they constructed some interesting models of particle physics, consistent extensions of the standard model, with quite distinctive predictions by employing these essentially anthropic arguments. Okay, so now let's move on to the motivation for our work. So most of the statistical studies of the landscape thus far have been concerned with type 2b flux landscapes. And one question is, are the results from these studies representative in any way of the landscape in general? And the only way you can find that out is by studying other regions of the landscape. So that was our main motivation, and we'll be, as I mentioned, studying Freund-Rubin and G2 holonomy landscapes. So let me begin by giving a one-slide summary of some of the important results from these type 2b studies. So the first question one can ask is, what is the number of vacua? And the answer in the type 2b case is approximately this. So here L is this B3 brain tadpole number. B3 is the number of 3 cycles in the Calabi-L. R is the curvature on the moduli space, and omega is its scalar form. This integral is over some region in the moduli space. So if you're interested in the number of vacua in some region in the moduli space, you have to make this integral. Now, let me elaborate a bit on this formula. This was derived by Ashok and Douglas. And it's actually the number of vacua counted, number of supersymmetric vacua counted with signs on the moduli space. So it's really an index density. In actual specific examples, this formula was confirmed. Now, if you are in a region where the curvature of the moduli space, if you're in a smooth region of the moduli space, this is just simply proportional to the volume of that region in the moduli space, which means that at least if the region is big enough, you have an approximately uniform distribution of the vacua. Similarly, the distribution of cosmological constants also turned out to be uniform. So this is a very important point in this type 2b flux landscape, especially as regards the cosmological constant problem. The volume distribution, at least this large volume suppression, essentially because we're balancing with this non-perturbative effect from this instanton generated superpotential for the volume moduli. So there's a suppression of the large volume compactifications. Now we can discuss the supersymmetry breaking scales, the distributions of supersymmetry breaking scales in the F term in the flux vacuum in which supersymmetry is broken by F terms. So this is the work of Deneff and Douglas. So when the F terms are small, one gets a uniform distribution of Susie breaking scales, and as Frederick reviewed, when you additionally impose small cosmological constant, one gets this f to the 5 factor, which numerically favors high scale supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so these are some of the basic features that we want to compare with in these other regions of the landscape that we'll study. So let's try and bear some of these results in mind. But before we discuss these other landscape, before we discuss the analogous results, I want to give a brief introduction into these G2 compactifications and Freund-Rubin compactifications, just for orientation. So G2 holonomy vacua first. So these are 4D n equals 1 vacua without fluxes. The 7 manifold should be endowed with very particular kinds of singularities in order to obtain non-abelian gauge groups and chiral fermions. As Witten pointed out, and actually as Sergei reviewed in his talk yesterday, there are some very extremely interesting particle physics features of these G2 compactifications. In particular, we can get supersymmetric ground unification. Light Higgs's heavy triplets suppress dimension 4 and dimension 5 baryon number violating decay operators, so that these are all natural features, so that the leading contribution to the baryon to proton decay amplitudes come from dimension 6 operators. From these results, it follows that quarks, leptons, and indeed Higgs's are localized in the extra dimensions in a way which is very similar to the ADD, Arkani-Hamid, Dimopoulos, Diwali story, although the extra dimensions don't have to be large, but what that means is that one gets very naturally hierarchies of Yukawa couplings, because the Yukawa couplings are generated by non-local effects. Even though we understand locally these singularities very well and very explicitly, we don't have a very useful explicit construction of compact G2 manifolds with these singularities. So it's an open mathematical problem to establish a useful construction of these things, even though we know that such manifolds do exist because of dualities. Okay, so now, before you turn on any fluxes, you just look at the vacuum Einstein equation. So a G2 holonomy metric is a Ricci flat metric, so it solves the vacuum Einstein equations. The manifold, as I mentioned before, has moduli, and there are precisely B3 of them, which leads to B3 chiral superfield moduli and multiplets in the effective four-dimensional supergravity theory. So the superpartners of these moduli are just axions. If you switch on fluxes in the bulk, this leads to a runaway potential which does not stabilize the moduli. So at best it leads to a potential which you could give a cosmological interpretation to, but it eventually will run away. And it will run away to the large volumes of decompactification region. So at late times will not lead to a realistic cosmology because the extra dimensions are too large. Now, Since the interesting particle physics of these models comes from localized fields localized at singularities, for example, non-abelian gauge fields are localized on three-dimensional submanifolds. One can ask, if you combine these bulk fluxes with localized fluxes, for example, localized fluxes for gauge fields and their superpartners, can you stabilize this runaway behavior? So that was the question I posed in this paper. And the answer is that yes, you can stabilize this runaway behavior, provided certain conditions are met. And this condition is simply a topological one. So let me just remind you that this three-cycle Q that supports the non-abelian gauge group is the locus of an ADE singularity inside X. So that close to Q, the manifold looks like that. In other words, the normal bundle of Q has fibers which are these orbifolds. So this is the condition. This is the condition that you have an ADE gauge symmetry in the theory, and the condition on the field supported on Q, the non-abelian field supported on Q, in order to for this stabilization to work, is to take place is that there's a complex flat connection where the gauge group is the complexified ADE gauge group, which admits whose Chern-Simons invariant, which is a complex number, is non-zero and in particular non-real. So this C2 here has to be non-real. And the reason for that is that in this theory, in the Super-Yang-Mills theory supported on Q, there's a gauge field, but it has a bosonic superpartner, which is another gauge field. So let's call this thing curly A. The contribution that this complexified gauge field makes to the four-dimensional superpotential is exactly the complexified Chern-Simons. Invariant, complexified Chern-Simons functional. And then when you combine this superpotential with the superpotential generated in the bulk by the bulk four-form flux, the conditions for stable critical points are that this imaginary part is non-zero. Right.
What is B?
B is just the normal bundle scalars on the D6 brain world volume. So for those of you who are more familiar with D brain configurations, if this is probably a nice point to raise, if you take a Calabi-Yau type 2A oriented fold of a Calabi-Yau 3 fold with D6 brain space filling D6 brains wrapping supersymmetric three cycles, then that configuration is a type 2A limit of such a G2 manifold, and this one form here B has its three components along this three cycle Q are just the three components of the three normal bundle scalars to the D6 brain inside the Calabi-Yau. Well, one will be honest, if one waits long enough. So these are the conditions, and I should say that these are, you know, one can more or less state this as a mathematical theorem. If such a three cycle exists, so you have an ADE singularity along a queue such that you have a non-real Chern-Simons invariant of that three cycle, then there exists a moduli free stable vacuum of M theory. It's very one of the advantages of this G2 approach is that one can, even though, as Sergei mentioned, constructing the examples is difficult, one can still state with certainty that under these conditions the solution exists. In that sense, if you had a good construction of these manifolds, this is would be a much more straightforward way of constructing moduli free vacua. You saw the length at which Florea, Deneff, Douglas, and collaborators had to go to construct examples of KKLT vacua, supersymmetric KKLT vacua. This approach here is not beset by any of those problems if one had a way of constructing these manifolds. Okay, now, so if you had examples, of course, by changing the fluxes, the bulk four-form flux, one gets a discretium of vacua. And we can ask, you know, how many vacua do we get? And how are the cosmological constants distributed and so on? Okay. Freund-Rubin vacua. These are the original flux compactifications that have been around for about 20 years or so, more than 20 years. They are flux compactifications to ADS4. So unlike the Calabi-Yau and G2 case, where the classical solution, for example, without the flux, is Minkowski space, these, at the leading level, these are ADS4 compactifications. So the classical background has an intrinsic scale set by the cosmological constant. It's an important feature of these vacua which distinguishes them to a certain extent from the special holonomy vacua. In modern times, thanks to work of Maldacena, we've come to appreciate these as duals of three-dimensional conformal field theories. And this is how, I mean, this conformal field theory point of view is how we've been thinking of these vacua in recent years. But in the old days, people tried to consider these as, you know, phenomenological models, including the Klein supergravity. There's a nice physics report by Duff, Nielsen, and Pope devoted to this subject. The problem with that was that chiral fermions were shown not to arise by Witten, but as we saw in the G2 holonomy case, chiral fermions can emerge at when the extra dimensions develop particular kinds of singularities, and in this paper we established that this can also happen in Freund-Rubin compactification. So I hope this revives the interest in these compactifications from a phenomenological point of view, which also has the advantage that it has a dual a holographic dual description. So, even though we established the existence of examples, we didn't. You know, we didn't. We're not the kind of people that know how to extensively explore all the possibilities. We're not particularly good at that kind of thing. So there are some open problems here. You know, for example, can you construct a three-generation SU5 gut in this way? Now, returning to this, another point is that it's the same. A priori, it's the up to the vault. I mean, naively, it's the same. But if the volume of X is small, you know, is parametrically small in all directions compared to the volume of the unit 7 sphere, then the Kaluza-Klein scale, Kaluza-Klein mass scale, can actually be parametrically larger. And in this paper, we actually presented an example where the Kaluza-Klein mass scale was about 5 times bigger than the ADS mass. The precise definition is, if you give me a 7-dimensional Einstein manifold with positive scalar curvature, then I will give you a Freund-Rubin vacuum in which that is the extra dimensions. No, in this vacuum, there's no cancellation mechanism. Because you don't switch on the flux through 4 cycles in the 7 manifold. Just the curvature, yeah. But there are other solutions that haven't been explored, in which you can also perturb these by additional fluxes. I mean, Neil Lambert had recently a paper on that. So the cosmological constant is small, but when n is taken to be large enough, but the precise condition is that the volume has to be small. So, well, we had an example in which we had a factor of 5 in the radius, so which is probably good enough, but. Okay. Now there are both supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric examples. In particular, there's this old idea which I think is due to Duff, which used to be called skew whiffing, but in modern terminology, it can be phrased in the following way: if you take a compactification of this type, which has unbroken n equals 1 supersymmetry and no more, so minimal supersymmetry, and you change the M2 brains into anti-M2 brains, you get a solution which is n equals 0, non-supersymmetric, but it's still stable in the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman sense. So it's a semi-classically non-supersymmetric stable. So for every n equals 1 compactification, there's an n equals 0 partner, just obtained by changing the sign of the flux. But it's just as stable as the supersymmetric one in the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman sense. Now, you can show that these things the classical solution is not realistic. One precise way of phrasing that is that the fundamental scale turns out to be just too low. So the key assumption here is that the fundamental scale is greater than or equal to the electroweak scale. And if you put that in and put the numbers in, you'll find that it's just a bit too low. You just can't satisfy that bound. So you must understand, for example, the quantum corrected potential. So for example, if you had a supersymmetry breaking gauge theory here, what are the quantum corrections? Can you cancel this bare negative cosmological constant? Maybe there are even some classical solutions which could uplift these negative cosmological constants to positive ones, or to zero. So analogous, for example, to the KKLT anti-D3 brains. So that's something which is worth exploring, I think. Okay. And one thing is they're much simpler than special holonomy vacua. You can write down explicitly the metrics. In this paper, we wrote down explicitly the metrics on these compact Einstein manifolds supporting chiral fermions, the exact solution, G equals 11 supergravity. Okay, so let's move onwards into these other regions of the landscape. So, this Freund-Rubin statistics is very simple, so we can more or less derive the results as we go along. At large n, well, okay, first point is that there's a free parameter, which is, in modern terminology, the number of M2 brains. So there's an infinite number of these vacua. But the infinity that emerges is the decompactification limit. The cosmological constant goes to zero, space decompactifies. So a much more sensible question is, how many vacua are there with volume bounded by some number V star? Okay. Since the volume in terms of the flux is given by this formula, this is how many such vacua there are. So this 6/7 power, you should try and remember that. Similarly, the formula for the cosmological constant up to numerical coefficients is that it goes like 1 over n to the 3/2. So the number of vacua where the cosmological constant is bounded from above has this minus 2/3 scaling with the cosmological constant. And the other direction, you get this runaway direction as the cosmological constant goes to zero. So this means that Freund-Rubin vacua, statistically, they prefer to be at large volume and small cosmological constant. That's when these numbers get big. So that's the basic, that is the basic Freund-Rubin statistics. But we can be a more, we can become a bit more refined. We can ask, in this context, quite nice question. I mean, in the type 2b case, these results were for a fixed, these distributions I showed you were for a fixed Calabi-Yau. You can ask, you know, what happens if you also include the set of Calabi-Yaus, change the topology of the Calabi-Yau. And in this Freund-Rubin case, you can do this sort of explicitly, the analogous problem. So you can ask, what happens if you also vary x and sample the topology of the extra dimensions? So let's construct simple ensemble of Freund-Rubin vacua. So if, for example, x has a U1 symmetry, and many Einstein 7 manifolds with positive scalar curvature do have such symmetries, for example, the 7 sphere, you can take a ZK quotient. That is still an Einstein 7 manifold with the same cosmological constant, but different volume. So you get an ensemble of Einstein manifolds labeled by an integer K. There are many much more complicated ensembles of Einstein manifolds, which we didn't explore, but one could do the analogous study for those. For example, the Gauntlet, Martelli, Sparks, Sasaki-Einstein metrics in 7 dimensions, which are labeled, which also come in infinite sets labeled by integers. So from this we get Freund-Rubin vacua now labeled by 2 integers, n and k. Now the previous results in the previous slide were for fixed k, some fixed Einstein manifold, but what we found is that sampling the extra dimensions in this simple way really enhances the previous results. So this 6/7 power becomes 6, gets increased to 6, which is a huge increase. And this minus 2/3 becomes minus 2, which is again a huge increase if, for example, you know, lambda star is 10 to the minus 100. So this just makes this point explicit. Sampling the topology of the extra dimensions really makes a big difference to the distributions of vacua. Okay, and these are two plots of these vacua. The first plot, so here, this denotes the lattice of vacua. Each point is a vacuum, and these lines are the lines of constant lambda inverse and constant volume. So if you're interested in, say, number of vacua in which the volume is less than a particular number, you can just have to count the number of points under this line and integrate under this, in the continuum approximation, this curve. And then if you add in the cosmological constant, then you can integrate over these, you know, some particular region and get a finite number of vacua here. Now this is the same plot but viewed in the V lambda space, and you can see that, for example, at fixed cosmological constant, there are more vacua at smaller volume, as this thickness of this line of these dots shows. This is very counterintuitive to what you would have guessed from just staring at a Freund-Rubin solution, which naively you would have thought there'd be more vacua at large volume. In the joint distribution, it's not true. You actually find regions where there are more vacua at perhaps small cosmological constant and small volume, which is a bit more phenomenologically interesting. And one wouldn't have considered this possibility otherwise. I didn't specify how it acts on any particular... It could act with fixed points or not, but if it acts with fixed points, you have additional degrees of freedom that you need to take into account. No, just stop.
So if you take K very large to get N, you start to look at small K and also small dot by the constant time.
Yeah. No, I mean, we've discussed this ourselves in the past. It depends, of course, very much on how this ZK symmetry acts. But it's clear that as K becomes large, some direction is becoming very, very small. And so, for example, as we've discussed before, you can get a light string-like state obtained by wrapping a brain. Yeah. So far we have nothing to suggest that the number of vacua in a finite region of configuration space is infinite. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Although there's still probably some details that need to be worked out on that idea. Okay. Now let's move on to the G2 holonomy statistics. So this is this case is much more complicated. The superpotential of these G2 compactifications is extremely simple. It does not depend on the G2 manifold. The only way it depends on the G2 manifold is through this, through the Chern-Simons invariant, which is just a constant. All the details of X come in through the Kähler potential. Since not much is known about G2 manifolds, not much is known about this Kähler potential on the moduli space. So what can we do about that? Well, in fact, we obtain many results on the distributions which are completely independent of the choice of Kähler potential, it turns out. Essentially, you know, using these techniques, these sort of general techniques that Frederick explained in his talk, taken from his work with Mike. But we also studied explicit ensembles of model Kähler potentials and obtained additional insight from those. So here are some of the results. The distribution of vacua is extremely uniform So for example, one can prove this formula for the distribution of supersymmetric vacua without reference, I mean, for a general Kähler potential in this case. This is much simpler than the type 2b case, because this is the exact number, or in the continuum approximation, this is the number, unlike the Ashok-Douglas formula, which was an index. This C2, you see, here, plays the role of this, in analogy with type 2b, plays the role of this D3 brain. Tadpole charge. And R is the region in moduli space. So this is the number of vacua. This well approximates the number of vacua in a region R of moduli space.
So one question about the analogy between C2 and the L in 2B. In 2B, L is associated with the tadpole. And for imaginary self-dual vacua, it really gave a bound on how many vacua you could have. And so there was a finite number associated with that. Now in this case, there is no analogous tadpole. Is that right?
No, but C2 is a finite number.
C2 is a finite number. So you still have an infinite number of vacua. The difference must be...
No, I don't.
In the 2B case, well, you've written in terms of a density. Really, in the 2B case, if I count all vacua below a certain value of L, there's only a finite number.
That's right.
But in this case, there's no reason for you to have a finite number. You haven't cut off the flux of something.
No, this is a finite region.
But if you integrate this over all of moduli space, that must diverge.
No.
Well, in the 2B case, it won't.
No.
Otherwise, where's the infinity?
I think the question you might ask is what bounds C2?
Yeah. Yeah,
But C2 isn't bounding the fluxes.
It is in some sense.
It is. And how is it bounding?
Well, okay. All this analysis is valid only in the supergravity approximation. If you go beyond the Planck scale, 11-dimensional Planck scale, I don't know what happens. But to stay within that approximation, you find that the moduli take values in which there's an natural upper bound on the flux. So the value of the moduli goes like C2 over some flux, and the moduli have to be bigger than 1. So n goes up to n takes values from 0 up to C2.
So in your approximation, you cut off the fluxes at some value determined.
Yeah. So there's a sort of practical cutoff, but in any finite region of moduli space, there's a finite number of vacua, regardless of what C2 is. Because C2 is finite.
As long as you put that.
Okay, large volumes are also suppressed, and C2 cuts those off. And the actual distribution of cosmodule constants actually just follows from the volume distribution, because lambda is roughly C2 squared over V cubed. And therefore, you get a suppression of small cosmological constants. But the distribution of cosmological constants is very different from the type 2b case. This is a very important point. You have a completely non-uniform distribution of cosmological constants. I mean, most of the distributions are actually just determined from the distribution of volumes. The Susie breaking scale turns out to be big. So numerically, it's preferred to be big. So these were sort of general results, independent of the choice of Kähler potential. But from the explicit model ensembles that we constructed, there was some additional notable information. Even though, a priori, there were lots and lots of de Sitter vacua in this potential, all of them, we could show, were unstable. They're all tachyonic, maxima of the potential. On the other hand, exponentially large numbers of anti-de Sitter vacua were established to be stable. So these are the two additional bits of information we found from the explicit ensembles. And just to give you, just to show you the non-uniformity of these distributions, here's some plots. So first of all, this is the joint distribution of vacua. In view of time, I'm not going to say too much about that. But let me focus here on the distribution of cosmological constants. This is plotted for some fixed value of C2 that we just chose at random. You see how peaked this distribution is. Similarly, the Susie breaking scale distribution is very peaked. So these highly peaked distributions are actually reminiscent of the friendly, so-called friendly landscapes recently introduced by Arcani, Hamid, Dimopoulos, and Katru. Those of you who will be going to the next conference will hear more about that. In view of the time, The distribution of supersymmetry breaking scales. It says it right there. This is from our ensembles of G2 vacua. It follows essentially from from the non-uniformity of this power here. Yeah, it just likes to have a big lambda. You mean that? It's a good question. I have to think about that. I mean, this was the plot for some specific models. I'll think about it and come back to you on that. Okay, so unfortunately, some recent work that we've been doing shows that the Yukawa couplings, so suggests that the Yukawa couplings appear to scan many orders of magnitude in these flux landscapes, which in the language of Arcani Hamid et al. Is very unfriendly. Yeah, sorry. I didn't introduce it. But for people that are familiar with that paper, in order to refer to it, it's much easier to use the language of the paper. But
No. But you should read.
Yeah, I think I agree with that too. Yeah. Okay. So, as we've seen, we initiated a statistical study of other regions of the landscape, which I want to emphasize has some practical utilities. I want to emphasize this point. So far, all of these landscape studies suggest that the number of 4D vacua with finite volume and cosmological constant is in fact finite. And our results suggest that most of the stable vacua on this landscape have a high scale of supersymmetry breaking. And I just want to finish by emphasizing this question. Do metastable de Sitter universes exist? Okay, thank you.
So can we interpret, or can anyone interpret the result that statistics are very different in different forms of life or very modular by saying that you probably think it's not universal, that would suggest that statistics don't know the majority of things, that most of the landscape.
I'm pretty sure that we do not know most of the landscape, but difficult to make progress on that question.
A more specific thing. What I would say, in my opinion, at the moment is that this is a universal result that comes out when you have one flux per cycle, and there are other problems that exist, such as the black hole, a distribution of black holes that only have a good number of charges and not other choice charges. Normally, it's similar to the flux vacuum and the attractor mechanism that governs the number of black holes that are given central charge, but it has this volume type of distribution. So that is a possible, and that, you know, that is a universal type of distribution, different from the 2B one, which is the property of having two types of flux. But the choice that they're not scanning, because we don't know the distribution of that parameter, is the choice of C2 here. So that's, if you look at it, that's like a lot of the old, the second type of flux. That's what allows us to put potential to become complex. So, if you thought that things were going to agree, you might make a hypothesis that properly scanning of a C2 would make them agree, which might or might not be true, but that's, I think, why at this point it's not totally surprising that they don't agree.
Yeah, I mean, another way of thinking of it is just in terms of duality. In the type 2B, you have, you know, more fluxes than moduli, and therefore you have additional degree of freedom to tune the value of the cosmological constant, and you get this uniformity. Here, there's one flux per modulus. So once you're in the vacuum, once you pick a flux, you're in some vacuum, and there's no more degree of freedom to tune. So we don't. If you try to make a duality between type 2B and the G2 case, we don't know what the dual of the Nevers-Schwartz flux is, for example. So perhaps, you know, more, if one could understand what these additional degrees of freedom were, you would. Yeah, but one way to see that, it would be to use the duality, right?
You could turn it around and try to say if we think we know what the universal answer is supposed to, we don't know what distribution is here, but we can spend. I don't know what the other thing, you know, the same thing, any connections you can try to draw between the different ideas.
Yeah. Hi, Sidon. Yeah. There's a lot of subtleties involved in trying to make these dualities.
Yeah.